So then in the discussion of the Eightfold Path that we've been doing this week, in the sequence we've been doing, it falls on tonight to be right concentration. Or as I indicated before, maybe concentration is not the best translation for samadhi. So right samadhi, appropriate samadhi. And the word samadhi holds a very respected place in Indian religions, so much so in some non-Buddhist religions. In Hinduism, sometimes samadhi is equated to what in Buddhism we call nibbana. And samadhi, I prefer the word samadhi to concentration. Concentration just seems like a particular functioning of the mind. And when we talk about samadhi, we're talking about something much deeper or much fuller than a particular functioning of the mind, particular focusing of the mind. And when I think of samadhi, it evokes for me the feeling of reverence. Something to have reverence for, or to approach samadhi, to approach it with a degree of reverence. Like if you would go to some temples, you would go with some reverence or some care or some respect, maybe putting aside your conceit, putting aside some of the, you know, self-importance that you might carry elsewhere, but or if you go to some great natural place like the Grand Canyon, for some people that evokes wonderment, but it can also evoke reverence. And the same thing in the context of this great, awesome nature, or standing on the edge of the Pacific, a certain kind of way in which, in a very healthy way, beautiful way, self-importance can fall away. We're just here, a little piece of this amazing universe. Or the kind of, for me, the kind of reverence, if you walk into a preschool class when all the kids are napping, you know, it calls for reverence. You know, and you don't want to, in great conceit, announce your arrival. I'm here. Look at me. I'm important. That's, you know, you go quiet. It's one of the great experiences of life to go into a preschool class when they're all napping. I recommend it. Reverence. So to approach samadhi with reverence is a very different approach than how a fair number of meditators approach it. A fair number of meditators approach it with acquisitiveness. I'm going to get it. Competition is not uncommon. The first one to get to first base. You know, and greed. There can be a lot of self conceit involved in becoming the one who gets concentrated. You want to wear the badge, the concentration badge. Look at me. Or the feeling of success. You know, you want to have tangible proof that you've spent all this time, a week, months, years meditating. And you want to have something to show for it. You know, in mindfulness, you're just left with what's happening. You know, it's not much to show, right? But with concentration, then you can, you know, you talk about your bliss, and, you know, what all those great experiences, and then you have proof that you're making along the way. And so there's a lot of insecurity sometimes around spiritual practice. You want to have something to show for it. So there's a lot, when people bring a lot to samadhi, some people are afraid of it, because it's kind of an altered state. But I think reverence, to approach it with a kind of quiet or care, or in the most healthy possible way, a certain kind of humility or humbleness. And one of the ways to, I think kind of appropriate humility or reverence with samadhi is to see it as a gift. That those times when there is a state of samadhi, a state of concentration arises, that it's not something we do, it's not something we make happen, but we put together the conditions for it, and then it's a gift, and you know, it's something that's just there, and it can be supportive for the overall path of practice. That's why it's part of the Eightfold Path. It's the final path, final step in the Eightfold Path. It has a lot of importance, but not for its own sake. And that's something people forget also about samadhi. Some people get so focused on the states, but we're not to attain them for their own states, but rather they are one way, and there's other ways, it's one way that's very supportive and helpful for walking the path. And I think of two primary ways that it's helpful. There's others as well. One is that it's very healing, samadhi, because samadhi is a state of completeness, feeling complete. So all the ways in which we feel fragmented, feel broken, start getting healed and be mended together, and we feel whole. And even if it's temporary in the state of samadhi, to have to be nourished and be informed and have the sense of completeness go into our bones and our cells begins to release and relax the messages that we carry in there that we're incomplete in some way, we're broken or something. And so it's understood to be a very healing. And then the other is that it's a state of well-being and stillness, stability, that gives you some of the best opportunities you have to see and let go of clinging, of attachment. And that's kind of the ultimate purpose of samadhi, is how it's a stepping stone, how it's a help and support for letting go. Letting go of our clinging. It's, you know, some of our clinging are really deep. Some of our clinging are so deep we don't even know we have them. We just know that, you know, we're caught, but we don't even know what. But as we get stiller and stiller, and hopefully in a kind of reverent way, respectful way, that we kind of begin seeing where we're holding, and it's easier to kind of, something begins to give, something begins to let go. So a word that is almost a synonym for reverence is respect. And I love the word respect for, as a synonym for kind of mindfulness rather than samadhi, because respect literally means, in the Latin roots of the word, to look again. And so always we're ready to look again. What's here? Let's look again. Everything deserves a second look and a third look. That's what we do in mindfulness. Just look again. As opposed to look once and then hit it with a sledgehammer. Look once and then run away or close up. But no, just keep looking. Look again. Respect. So samadhi is not a singular functioning of the mind. It's a state of mind, or a state of being. And that's why I like to translate samadhi as composure, because composure involves much more of our psychophysical being than, you know, just, you know, concentrate from the mind's eye at something. So we compose, our state of composure, or also of completeness. Often they talk about unification, state of unification. Everything gets unified. And the common experience for many people is to be fragmented. And it's very easy to be fragmented because we have so many different currents or channels within us, so many different processes going on inside of us, and they can be going at cross purposes. So for example, I could sit down to meditate, and my intention is to be in the present moment, be mindful. That's my intention. That's one process, intentional process. My thinking is wondering whether there's going to be chocolate left over after the Dharma talk, after this meditation. You know, there was a bowl before, and you know, I wonder if it's going to be more. And I wonder if I get up first and race out, you know, but I can't race out because that doesn't look very meditative. So how do you kind of leave quickly without letting on that you're racing? And you know, and because I don't want to be seen as someone who's non-meditative and wanting chocolate. So how do we do this? Maybe if I sneak out before the bell rings, and no one will notice they have their eyes closed. So the thinking processes are going, and they're talking, I think, planning, right? But then at lunch, you were standing in line with your plate, and the person in front of you said, "I'll wash your plate for you." And you're kind of like blown away by the generosity and the care and the compassion. How could someone, wow, that was such a kind thing to do. And so part of you is kind of all warm still and delighted. Wow, that was quite something. You feel kind of settled, part of you. But you haven't slept well last night. So you're tired too, and you feel this heaviness and a little headache from it, and you're worried about tonight. So there's a whole other process going on. So I could go on and on, right? And then your body aches, right? You've been sitting here for days, and you have this achy shoulder and knee, and you're concerned about it, and it's been hurting for a while, and you've never had, you know, aching knee for so long, and it's probably cancer. So your body is doing one thing, and your tired system are doing another thing, and your intentions are doing one thing, and your thoughts are doing something else, and your emotions are doing multiple things, and so it's all going in cross purposes, all like not harmonized, not working together. Samadhi is when all these different processes we have come together and are working together in harmony for the same purpose at the same time in the same place. They're organized, they're aligned together. And I remember when I was in elementary school, we would bring magnets to school, and little red magnets, you know, UN magnets, and we would pull the magnets across the sand, the sandbox, and there were these little kind of iron flints, black iron flints in the sand, and they would, you do it over and over again, and the iron would line up, kind of. And we loved doing it, you know. So samadhi is partly kind of, we do it over and over again, and things begin lining up. You know, everything lines up and comes together and works together rather than all scattered and everything. So unified. So I like also the word to be complete, we become whole. The fullness of this moment. We open, relax, settle into the fullness of this moment. So it's all here. We're not shutting off parts of ourselves. We're not pushing some parts away. We're not holding on to some parts. We don't have blinders. We're not... actively, you know, kind of pushing things away. Just that we're complete, we're here, fully. The primary, the tradition says that one of the primary obstacles to this feeling of being complete is the five hindrances. And it makes some sense, especially for the first two hindrances, desire and aversion, because they're already a state of being split, because we're focusing on an object, either the object of desire, so much so that we're kind of lost in that preoccupation, we lose touch with ourselves in a certain kind of way, or the object of aversion, what we don't like or angry with, and we lose touch with ourselves. We're kind of split between subject and object when we have strong aversion or strong desire. And so in order to become complete, we have to find some way to overcome this dramatic split between subject and object that happens with desire and aversion. And so at some point we want to let go of that split, and ideally either let go or have fade away the subject-object kind of intensity of desire and aversion. So there's no more desiring, sensual desire, no more aversion, ill will operating. And it's not an easy thing to do, and it can be quite subtle, the thoughts we have, wanting, not wanting, pushing away. And so a big part of this kind of practice, the reverent, respectful approach, is to take your time and learn how desire and aversion works for you. We're meant to become hindrance experts. We should advertise our retreats that way. hindrance retreats. We call them mindfulness retreats. Maybe we should really call them hindrance retreats. And so so it's not a mistake that you have the hindrances. It's okay. It's really okay. And then there's restlessness, regrets, remorse. That can run so deep, like broken-hearted remorse and regrets, that also involve a split or separation, to kind of hard to be complete when we're kind of caught in the grip of that. And then there's sloth and torpor, which to some degree has a lot to do with resistance, kind of unwillingness, because it's not just tiredness, this is a deeper kind of psychological thing, also kind of not complete. And doubt, also doubt is very splitting. We're not committed, we're not sure, we're kind of held back, we don't know which way to go. And so there's kind of not really connected. And so to overcome those obstacles is we have to somehow overcome these if there's going to be a state of completeness, of completion, of completeness, wholeness. And so there needs to be a willingness, if we're going to do this practice, a willingness to disinvest ourselves from the hindrances, a willingness to understand that the path is not found by getting more chocolate. The path is not found by having aversion or to the noisy people around us in the meditation hall. The path is found by relaxing the aversion, relaxing the desire, and settling into this experience more fully here. So at least understand in principle that's where it's found, because some people really believe in desire, really believe in aversion, and so they don't disinvest themselves from it. But to do this path, really have to understand that this is not where the path is found. And then, of course, it's not easy to let go of those, but at least it begins by knowing that that's not where the path is found. So at some point, the hindrances fall away, fade away, probably temporarily, but they no longer grab us. We're not pulled into their orbit so strongly. And then the Buddhist tradition, the ancient tradition, talks about something very interesting that happens at that point, that can happen. It talks about with the fading away of the hindrances, there arises gladness. And with the arising of gladness, there comes delight. And with the arising of delight, there comes tranquility. With the arising of tranquility, there comes joy. And with the arising of joy, there comes samadhi. So, gladness, delight, tranquility, joy, samadhi. Three of those five factors are in the family of joy or happiness or well-being. So there's something that can happen, when we let go of the mind that's so distracted and caught up in its concerns and its past and future, and really settle into being here in a full way. And we no longer feel the mind being pulled, constantly being pulled into thoughts, pulled into concerns. It's possible at that point to appreciate, enjoy the fact that we're no longer being hijacked, no longer being pulled off this way and that way. And it's, for some people, it's not an automatic thing that they feel that joy and delight. So it's good to hear that you're encouraged to do that. That feels nice. This is good. Wow, it feels really good to be here and not be distracted, not be pulled left and right by desire and aversion and so forth. Because that joy or that delight or that sense of well-being is nourishing and supports the growth of samadhi. Samadhi grows on, the word is tranquility usually, but tranquility, relaxation, and happiness, which is very different than how I used to try to get concentrated when I was a new practitioner. I thought I just had to bear down more, strain more. And oh boy, was I good at straining. And I would get really, really focused and trained, and I would get into a first-class meditative headache from that. If you want to know how to get a good meditation headache, I'll tell you. So the idea that the goal for when you know you have a samadhi mind, the mind is soft. And you don't get a soft mind by having a hard mind, by getting harder. You get a soft mind by softening, by relaxing. And so it took a long time for me to learn that. That was part of the picture. So so when we're no longer fragmented and distracted, when we kind of finally arrive and we're here, and start feeling more complete, then we can avail ourselves a certain kind of joy. The first joy is the joy of not being distracted anymore. The joy of just being. And at this point, the tradition offers a beautiful simile, kind of an image for how practice can unfold at this point. And it's the image of bath powder. In the ancient world, I mean, I don't know if maybe still some places, they'd have soap powder for the baths. They used to have public baths, and there was a bath attendant. And one of the jobs of the bath attendant was to turn the soap powder into soap dough. I don't know what they did. And so they would take this powder, kind of like we would take flour and make it into dough and sprinkle water on it. They would take this soap powder, and they would sprinkle water in it, and then they'd knead it thoroughly, kind of massage it thoroughly, so that the moisture of the water would spread completely throughout the powder. So every piece of powder was moist. And there's work involved, kind of the work of kneading and mixing and squeezing it that's involved. So at this point we're kind of finally here. We're not distracted so much anymore. We're here and present. But there's still some, we're still engaged in the process of staying here. We're still needing to we have to massage or knead or keep applying ourselves to stay here. Bring our attention, place our attention, and then keep it there, and then do it again, and keep it there. The mind doesn't wander off very far, but just enough that we have to kind of keep coming back, keep massaging it, keep staying. There has to be some intention, there has to be some application. It's a little bit of effort or work, making the effort to stay, because if you don't make any effort at all, directed effort, receptive effort, but some kind of effort that can stay, mind wanders off kind of easily. So there's still you need to be part of it. And so this thing of kneading, massaging, I think it's a beautiful kind of, just stay there, massage. I don't think we knead the bread violently, you don't whack it. You have to kind of, especially the bigger the dough, the more you kind of just take your time. It's kind of a sensual thing. Knead it out, smooth it out. So we're smoothing out the mind, opening up, staying present, and enjoying it. And then as we settle, as it gets more peaceful, as we get more still, and that's one of the guidelines for practice, is what helps us move towards greater stillness? What helps us to move to a quieter mind? Quieter mind. what helps the surface of the lake go from being churned up by the wind to becoming still and quiet. So we have the mind becomes like a quiet surface of a lake. So then, as this practice continues, at some point this kind of magic happens, or this very special kind of gift happens, where it's clear that you're in the present moment. And if the mind does start going into thoughts about the past and the future, those thoughts pale in importance. It's like so uninteresting. It's like you've been watching Technicolor, and they ask you to go back in black and white. You know, just like, it's, you know, just kind of like, it's just not alive. And so at some point, you know, the thoughts that seem so important, so captivating that you had, you know, they no longer seem so interesting. What was I thinking? Why was I so, you know, just, they bubble up and like, please, you know, I don't need to, I'm not interested in that. And at some point it becomes just, we don't have to make any work, do the work, we don't have to do any needing anymore, applying ourselves to stay present, just to be. And then just being just is. We're just really here. And the state of being just here, it's kind of like, I think this works, that if you make a fist for a long time, a really tight fist, and then after a while, and while you release the grip, all this nice energy, like blood or something, courses through your hand. It just feels so good and tingling and delightful to feel the release that happened. So as we settle in deeper, we feel more complete. The holdings of our life, the resistance we have, the desires, the grasping, the pushing, releases, and the energies of our body, our system, begins to flow much more freely. And here they give a very nice simile. And the simile is of a lake that is has no streams, no rivers running into it. Though occasionally there are celestial rain showers that bring water in. Heavenly water rains in a little bit. And in this river, in this lake, there is an underground spring. Fountain where the water enters in, and that beautiful, cool, wonderful. Remember, cool because India. Cool, refreshing water upwells, comes upwelling, and moves through the lake. It's current of fresh water, and refreshing water moves through the lake. So the not any streams coming in. It said because now we're not really taking in or be involved with the world of the senses. We're not, you know, we still might hear things and see things exactly, but we're no longer involved. We're not like concerned, or because we're kind of so much, just the state of being is so full, so complete, that we're not concerned about these other places. We're not bringing in data, and that data is not influencing us. And what's very nice is that this upwelling of the spring from inside is like the joy, the well-being, this nice vitality that starts flowing in this release of just being. It doesn't depend on anything in the world. You haven't won the lottery. You haven't gotten the date with your ideal person. You're not getting a massage. It doesn't depend on chocolate. You're not being fed by the world. That's the streams coming into the lake. But rather the joy is welling up from the inside out. Which is a nice thing, right? To have it for yourself inside. State of being, relaxing, opening up. You know, just here, fully here. To be in the fullness of this moment, this time. Letting go, relaxing, opening. Receptive. So here again, this point, there's no more effort made to be present. We're just present, and there's this upwelling, refreshing feeling, energy in the body. Then if there's more settling going on, settle more peaceful, then that current, the upwelling current fades away, and the lake becomes still. And here the simile becomes that of, in fact, of now again, a very refreshing pool of water, lake of water, but there's no current anymore. It's very still, very peaceful. And there are multicolored lotus flowers, lotus plants. They're floating in the lake. They say, they give red, blue, white, I don't know what different colors they are, but they mention different colors. And some of them submerged and some of them on the surface. Apparently, lotus flowers can bloom or something underwater or something. Or maybe they're buds, I don't know what they are, but these multicolored. And here, there's no part, these, well, the ones submerged under the water, no part of the lotus flower is not touched by the water. And in this simile, as we sit and just be in a state of being, being complete and quiet and still, no part of us, no part of us is separated, not in touch with, the sense of well-being that feels more satisfying than the joy of the upwelling energy that happened earlier. A deep sense of pleasure, deep sense of sublime well-being or sublime pleasure. And the idea of these beautiful lotus blossoms, you know, it says that in this point in meditation practice, there's a lot of confidence. We're confident, and there's a unification. This is where the sense of being unified becomes really strong. We're just really just here as a whole. And maybe the idea of a lotus blossom, maybe even a bud, just whole, and just floating in the water. And it's beautiful. And the clear water, you see clearly. There's clarity. And again, there's no more work. It's just kind of happening, just settled, very peaceful. They say that there's a mindfulness is quite strong, and there's a lot of equanimity. Some people refer to it as kind of a, sometimes they, people who are new to it call it natural awareness, or natural state of the mind, just clear and awake, and you know, because the mindfulness is so natural, so effortless, and the equanimity is so great, the mind doesn't get ruffled by anything. It's clear. You feel this unruffleability. Is that English? Of the mind. And then it says that, and then it gives it one more image for this process of samadhi. And this, and now the next image is no longer in the water or using water, but rather I think my understanding of it, maybe it's my interpretation, is that you've been in the water, you've been drenched by this peace, this delight, this joy, this sense of well-being, this subtleness. It's been nourishing, refreshing. You've been in the water, but then you come out. And you sit on the edge of the pond. And the image of a person who is completely wrapped in a white, new, clean sheet of cotton. Cotton sheet, cotton blanket, cotton towel. So when I was, 9 or so years old, I would take a bath in the evening before going to bed. And sometimes my mother, I don't know how she, nowadays I can't understand how she did the timing of it, but I would come out of the bathtub at 9 o'clock to go right into bed, and she had washed and dried my sheets. So when I got into bed, my sheets were warm. It was so cozy. So, you know, just get there cozy and nice. So this idea of kind of being wrapped in a sheet and... Or maybe, I don't know, if any of you as little kids made your little house with sheets over the dining room table, you know, and you crawled underneath, and it was like so safe and cozy and just a little world, and it felt so nice. So at this point in meditation, it's like you're wrapped in this clean sheet, white sheet, new sheet of cotton, and you're completely covered. And here they say that... there is something better than joy or happiness, but a deep sense of peace, deep sense of equanimity, deep state of confidence, deep state of pure, deep state of purity. The mind feels very pure. That's why maybe this pure blanket. And no part of you is not covered by it. And that it being completely covered, I think, has the idea that it's kind of like in a bubble, kind of complete, full, here. There's not really a lot of input from the world around anymore. Very still. I love it that this tradition offers these as similes. Because as similes, we don't have to get too wrapped up in exactly what these states of samadhi are, like getting the right samadhi. But it's more like an intuitive sense. We can feel our way. Some of us can imagine an intuitive sense of these different ways of settling and feeling complete and being here, of letting the mind become quiet. Because the divided mind, the divided self, has a lot to do with the mind being divided and busy and active and settling, getting quiet. So when the tradition talks about right samadhi, they describe it as this process that involves these different states of being, of completeness that go on. It's not necessary to experience all these. And any point along the way, after letting go of the hindrances, after you have to kind of somehow figure out how to no longer be caught by the hindrances. So there's a lot of work, a lot of patience and time to learn what it takes to become really understand the hindrances well, understand how the tricks of your mind. There's no way around learning how the tricks of your mind work, so you're not tricked by it. That takes time. But sooner or later, you learn the tricks well enough, you can put it aside and just be. And without putting aside the hindrances, it's very hard to really do the deeper work of letting go. And then once the hindrances are gone, at any different of these stages of samadhi, we can be poised any moment to be able to see deeply what we hold on to and let go. And one of the things that we hold on to is a sense of self, me, myself, and mine. In the beginning of a talk, I evoked the idea of reverence and a certain kind of healthy humility as being important. And it's important in and of itself, but it's also important because as we move into samadhi, as we move into this possibility of letting go, one of the things we're letting go of is the tight grip that we have on self. Self-importance, self deprecation, is that a good one? All these ideas of self and how we want to be seen by others, how we want to be liked by others, and what people have done to me and what they should have done and what they should do. And there's a whole constellation of activity of the mind that all centers around me, myself, and mine. It's quite humbling if you pay attention to what you're actually thinking and to realize that most of your thoughts have you at the center. It's kind of amazing. Most people wouldn't want to admit it. So at some point there's a deeper letting go, and it's a really amazing thing to let go of self-concern. Not once and for all. We don't then stop taking care of ourselves. But in this state, especially in meditation, where it's a safe place, to sit and just be and have enough trust to let go there of self-preoccupation. Let go there of measuring and understanding and orienting ourselves around this idea of self, me, myself, and mine. What happened to me, where I came from, what's going to happen to me, where I'm going, what I want, what I don't want, what I need. Who am I? Who will I become? Who was I? It's all these kinds of concerns. But to put all those aside as unnecessary in that state of completeness. And it helps to let go of it because that's one of the reasons samadhi can be so helpful. Because samadhi feels good. It feels like a state of good completeness. And so it's who needs these thoughts about self in that state? You know, like, give me a break. I've done that long enough. It had its chance. How old are you? I'm 59, right? 59 years of thinking about Gil, and look where it got me. It didn't help that much. You had your chance. Let's give a few minutes here, and like maybe like next 45 minutes. Let's try something different. You know, that's a sign of wisdom. If you do one thing long enough and it doesn't work, try something different. So for 45 minutes, try it without yourself. I mean, just 45 minutes versus 59 years, however old you are. You know, isn't that reasonable? Try it out. And it's remarkable how little you're needed. It's one of the great things to let go of self-concern or self-identity or self-selfing. Letting go of, or maybe the better word is self-centeredness, to orient and have an idea of self, put oneself at the center, and everything's about self in some way or other, good or bad, and just to kind of let go. I can't let go of self. I'm so caught up in self. I'm just terrible because I'm attached to self, isn't it? There's more, you know, we get caught in this cycle of self. It's not easy to let go of it, not easy to let go of its grip, but that's part of this idea of, you know, becoming sitting and just being complete here. It's so helpful to begin softening, letting go, trusting, having the trust that it's okay not to play the old games of self. And it's a remarkable thing to sit quietly, peacefully, simplicity of being, and to not have selfing, not have self-concern or self-orientation or self-centeredness present. And it's kind of like if I need to be seen by all of you as being a well-dressed man, you know, dresses well and all that, and then one day I show up giving a Dharma talk in blue jeans, the old blue jeans that have torn a little bit, and you know, and so, and then worse than that, time for Q&A, and one of you raises your hand and says, "Gil, what's with you in blue jeans?" This is kind of like, not really right. So if the idea of being well-dressed and seen that way is really important for me, it's like I'm holding up a flag. Buddhism, they talk about holding up a flag, holding something up, and you're like questioning me and maybe even criticizing me. Can you believe that guy? It's like your criticism or your thoughts or your judgments hits that place in me. And it hurts. Ow. But what if I don't have any concept, any concern about what I wear and what you think about me? And my whole sense of self is not tied up in my clothes and what you think about my clothes. And if that's the case, then I'm not holding anything up. And then you might say all kinds of vile things about my clothes. And here it comes, the vile thing. Just goes right by. So one way it hits something, and the other way it just goes, doesn't hit anything. Does that make some sense? So with that kind of analysis, so when we finally can let go of putting self at the center, it's kind of like the key to the kingdom. It's kind of like what the Buddhist tradition is pointing to as a deeper kind of lasting or more valuable kind of happiness. Because all the things of the world that come and go, come and go. But it's not hitting anything. And it's just there, it's there. You see it, you're present for it. In fact, you can be more present and more compassionate and more connected in a wise way. It isn't like you become aloof or disinterested, but it just doesn't, there's nothing to hit inside of us. Just praise and blame, just goes right by. Success and failure, all these things that happen. And it can seem pretty, to the mind that's caught up in success and failure and self, it can seem kind of bleak to not have those things. But it's so nice to have the spaciousness, the openness, the release, to just be alive and be present, and have the impermanent life that comes and goes and has suffering and challenges and all kinds of stuff that goes on, but not have it hit anything, not have it meet anything. Doesn't have to be anything here. Doesn't have to be anything here that it meets. So they say that if you really turn the mind around to see yourself, you're not there. You won't find anything. And that's really good news. That's really good news, because if you're not there, there's no one there to have problems. Isn't that kind of radical? But if there's someone there holding up its hand, it's easy to have problems. So it's a radical, it's my best effort right now to point you to a radical transformation, radical reorientation that the Buddhist tradition is pointing to. And one of the approaches to learning to this deep letting go, this deep release, is the Eightfold Path. It's a beautiful path. It involves using our cognitive abilities the best we can, our understanding, our intelligence. It involves using our intentional capacity, our attitudes, and bringing forth the best attitudes we can of compassion and care and loving kindness. It involves being as impeccably ethical as we can. It's a great thing to have ethical people. I mean, some people thought that was, you know, it was kind of good news, this thing about no self there. I thought I'd get away with all kinds of things. If no self, then I can do anything I want. What? I have to be ethical too? How does that work? Anyway, so it involves our ethics and our relationship to the world around us and people. And it involves how we do things, how we engage, our effort. It involves the cultivation of mindfulness. And the cultivation of mindfulness is not just mindfulness that's cultivating. The cultivating of mindfulness also is cultivating inner strength. Becoming strong, even courageous at times. To keep showing up. Keep showing up to be here and present. It creates a strong person. And this idea of there's no one here lends itself to the idea that I'm just kind of like a couch potato, blob, you know, just like Mr. Natural. So, but in fact, it's the opposite. The people who have followed the path and matured in it have become strong people, courageous people. confident, with lots of self-understanding, lots of compassion, lots of, I like the word confidence. They're here. I mean, conventionally, they're like here. And then there's samadhi, right samadhi, which is cultivating or calling or evoking our capacity to be whole, to be complete. Sense of kind of experiential sense of wholeness, completeness, subtleness, stability, composure, to be composed here. To an image that I've liked for myself for composure, for samadhi, it has also to do with a lake. And that is dropping a flat, little flat stone into the lake. And it's flat enough and light enough, it doesn't kind of go as fast as it possibly can, but it kind of sinks down into the lake and then settles on the bottom and sits there. So to sit here and allows, really be here, allow something to settle. Settle and be composed and be here. To discover how to trust this moment. So we're not at odds with it. Willing to enter this moment. The wonderful mystery, the reverence of this moment. The reverence of this moment. So we come back, mind drifts off, we come back, mind drifts off, we start again. And then after a while, this massage, coming back and applying ourselves, coming back and staying there, begins to become more and more effortless. And as you get more settled on retreat and here and this time in the retreat, I'd encourage you to be the guardians, the safekeepers of your practice. Stay close in. Stay close to your, if it feels right, stay close to your samadhi bubble, to your practice bubble. Remember one of the images of the no more streams coming into the lake. See if you can kind of, in a nice, soft, relaxed way, that don't get pulled into sights and sounds and thoughts and things that are far away and other times and other places. See if you can come back and just be here. Don't get more input. You've had enough input over a lifetime. What's here? What's your lake like? Can you quiet your lake? Enter your lake. And I'm very confident that each of you has within you a beautiful lake with beautiful lotuses. May you settle in and allow the beautiful emerald lake that you have, your mind, your heart, to nourish you as you feel, if you allow yourself to just be fully here. Fully yourself. And then let's take a few moments. Sit here and settle in, connect.